From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
The wonderful Jimmy Tarbuck. Nice to see you again.
Good to see you, John. You're on youth pills, I think. You look great. Good on you.
Do I?
I think it's the Isle of Wight does. I think it does to everybody. You know what I love over there? Everyone's so polite, friendly. It's a nice place to go.
And I must say, we're at your golf club.
Yeah, good to have you here.
Coombe Hill?
Coombe Hill Golf Club, where I've played for 50 years here now. And still enjoy it.
We've known each other since, Mr. Tarbuck, 1979, when you first came to do your summer season.
I think it was then, but my sister had told me about you. And my father said you have nothing to do with him. Yeah, I think it was that. And we had a lot of fun down there. I rented a house. I had one house on the cliffs that was the Lord Mayor of somewhere. Because he was mayor, he couldn't use his house that summer. And we lived on top. And there was a little five houses down below, a hamlet, I suppose you'd call it, and the fishermen were in there, and I got the best lobsters and the cheapest lobsters in my life. I suppose you'd be one in a couple of these, would you? My children were brought up thinking lobster was an everyday treat.
Hasn't comedy changed in our lifetime?
Oh, dear, dear. Totally. Some very funny boys about. Of course there are. Peter Kay. He's funny. He's good in character parts as well as the spoken word. John Bishop, he's swearing a bit too much, and I don't think he should because he's a funny guy. Macca, he's bouncing all over the stage.
Yes.
But he's got a wonderful personality.
Do you know what, Jimmy? I watched the Palladium show, and there's a few young comics. And one or two, they come on and they're as bright and breezy as you were all those years ago. I think it's terrific.
Oh, yes.
I think, God, that reminds me of Tarby.
Well, of course, that's the energy of youth and the excitement of it all. And, of course, in all my shows there, bar one, they were live. And that's a word, John, when you put any performer, singer, dancer, actor, comic. It's live. You can't go, stop that, I'll do that again. Now, I hit a bum note there. Just replay that bit. You can't do it. It's warts and all. And it's good for the old jam tart. And it's very good for the bottle, as they say.
Well, I used to watch you live at the Palladium, and I used to think, what were you thinking? Because, you know, you've got to remember all those gags. And I know you sometimes didn't get them till probably the afternoon, did you?
Well, you know, a dear, dear late friend of ours, Wally.
Yes.
I mean, he'd write some in the dressing room. The door would knock. Half an hour, sir. Hang on, Jim, I've got this one. You go, okay, Wally, let's have it. And you go, you know, whatever it was. Mrs. Thatcher said to Gorbachev. And you think, get your lips and that round that. Don't go on and say, Mr. Thatcher said to Gorbachev, because they at home say, what did he say? And that's where one of my tricks, if you want, with Frankie Howard, you can see their tricks. It's, oh, don't. No, listen. Listen. Verily thee, verily not. Titter thee not. That's him thinking.
Right.
Doddy, it's by Jove. What a wonderful day. Here we are, Mrs. O. And he's getting it all ready for bang killing them, you know. Tommy Cooper, well, Tom would tell the same gag twice, and he'd get out about someone shouted, you've told that, you go, oh, yes, I was just testing, and you'd cry with laughter. Malcolm and Wise, of course, that's when two of you on the stage bouncing off each other. What a job they did. I mean, he would be termed in my book, Eric Malcolm, as a comedic genius. Eric Sykes, comedic genius. Tommy Cooper, just funny bones. You see, there's two types of comedy, John. There's men who say funny things, and there are funny men. He was that. Bob Monkhouse, he said funny things. I'm trying to give you the difference. And Doddy, of course, he could always fall back on a lovely voice, as could Harry Secombe. He was like your lovable big uncle. And that's the difference with the comics of my era and today. I don't know if some of these lads had the apprenticeship that I had, working with those and learning from them. And learning from people like Spike Milligan, who was on the moon, and sometimes off the moon. You know? Then you got Harry came on, who'd do two raspberries. Oh, by Jove! You know, and Doddy, and that they all go about it a different way. Dickie Henderson, I learned from him. Frankie Vaughan. Just watching them every night, their artistry and their total professionalism. It was fascinating.
For my 25th wedding anniversary, my late wife now, sadly, but we came up to the Palladium for the day at Wally's invitation, right?
Yes.
And we met you in the dressing room, had a quick chat. And it was the night, Jimmy, that Sunita was one of the guests. Tom Jones was on and Mark Walker and Joe Longthorne. But Sunita was nearly wearing a very short dress. Do you remember that?
Nearly wearing it. I think the guys on the front row are still getting over their heart failure. She was a beautiful looking girl. And that's when I came on to Tom, if you remember, with a glass of champagne.
Yes, I remember it well.
And I said, cheers. And he'd been sick with a nodule on his throat. I said, on behalf of all of us, we're pleased you're feeling better. Well, he says, thank God, and so am I. And then I went into him. I said, it was a vasectomy, wasn't it? Well, he couldn't move.
That was the day when you were in the dressing room ready for the show. Felix Bonas was the warm-up comic.
Oh, yes.
And he got me stood up on the front row of the balcony, and he was teasing me and had a bit of fun, you know.
Good. So, great. He was good, Felix. He was great to go on there and warm them up. And he was a funny guy in his own right in Heidi High, and he occasionally popped on Dad's Army and things.
Put that light out!
I'm trying to relax and listen to John Hannum.
I want to talk to you about John Lennon. You went to school with him, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
What was he like then, Jim? What was he like?
Well, he was a great one. He had a way with words, even in those days. He would change words around. He was often very late. And we had a headmaster called Pop Evans. And he was coming down the corridor one day, and John came up the door. He went, Lennon? Yes, sir. He said, it's 9:20. He said, well, you're late, aren't you, sir? Well, that went round the school, and he became a bit of a hero. And then sat in with him at a history lesson, because the houses at the school were called Nelson, Raleigh, Drake and Wolfe, all historical figures, military-wise, in our history. And anyway, got us together, and this teacher said, Drake. He said, he circumnavigated the world, he said, in so many days, in a cutter. And so Lennon was paying her. Lennon? Yes, sir. What do you know about Drake? He said, he circumcised the world in a cutter. Well, the whole class just roared. And even the teacher roared at that. He was there, but people said, did you know he was a genius? Of course not. You know, he was a kid. We were all growing up together. And there was the famous photograph that Harry Bolt took. Harry Bolt was a teacher that went everywhere. It was when we were all on holiday in the Isle of Man. And there it was, John Lennon, myself. A guy called Jimmy Blaine, played many years for Exeter football, played at Everton and that, and a few others. And then I saw him in later life, and I remember going to a Beatle concert at the Apollo Hammersmith. John, I can't tell you and the listeners, you never heard noise like it. This wall of girls screaming. And girls of all ages, and even some of their mums, screaming their heads off. And they were doing, if there's anything that you want. He just moved his lips. And I was stood in the wings as close as you are here, watching. And he went to me, what's the point?
Those days, sort of two people were classed as the fifth Beatle sometimes. You were one of them.
Yeah.
And Georgie Best was the other one.
Well, yes, you can see the association. Me, because of the Liverpool thing, and George. We all had the same haircut. It's a great haircut to have. You pulled it forward and all. Oh, sorry about haircuts. And we did all that. And people never get to say who influenced the Beatles. No doubt about it. There were a group in Liverpool, a good group. Then they went to Hamburg and they were playing five sets a night, but the same 10 songs. And Little Richard was in Hamburg and they saw him. And there's no doubt about it with me, that's where Paul got the woo and all that when he, I mean, they always did Long Tall Sally as a tribute to Richard, who, if you never saw him, was the greatest rock and roll performer I've ever seen, bar none. Forgetting the audience, Rip It Up, Long Tall Sally. You know, he was just unbelievable. Well, it's Saturday night and I just got paid. Then Good Golly Miss Molly would make the hairs on your neck stand on end. He had a great band. He was wonderful. And he influenced the Everly Brothers. The harmonies certainly influenced them. But the writing, of course, was all their own. I mean, you look and you think there's two lads there. Well, three there who wrote three unbelievable songs on their own. Paul McCartney, Yesterday, along with The Long and Winding Road, John Lennon's Imagine, and perhaps the best love song came from George Harrison, Something. What a song to play for your lady.
Wonderful.
This is for you.
Vassy did a brilliant version.
Oh, superb. I've heard that played, and a friend here, Something at funerals by the husbands when I don't bring memories for yourself up, but just that.
Jimmy, when you first came on the Palladium 1963, it was an amazing, you were so fresh and you became a sensation overnight, didn't you?
Well, I'd driven through the night. It was October the 27th, 63. And I was on a club in Stockport. And Pauline and I drove through the night, slept in the car. And when you want something desperately, and I wanted to appear on the Palladium, and I thought I'd appear there once and go back to being a good club comic, which I was around the Manchester and Liverpool and Northwest areas. And I thought, I'll go on once, but I can say when I'm old, yeah, I played the Palladium. And of course, it didn't work out like that. But when I was on the clubs, I desperately wanted to appear with Bob Hope. Never dreaming I'd appear with him and Crosby and Judy Garland, Rudolf Nureyev and Dame Antoinette Sibley, and then all the other great stars, Bassey, Jones, the Beatles. You just keep going. And I thought, dear Lord, you are a lucky boy. But it's something I wanted desperately. I wanted to try to see if I could do it. I wanted to try to see if I could do it all around the world. And I wanted to do it desperately in America with Hope. And he gave me that opportunity.
You came to the Isle of Wight Sunday concerts early on in your career for a guy called Don Moody.
That's right.
And one night, it was a full house, and you were going on and on and on, and you said, throw me the keys on, I'll lock up. And Don was in the wings, and he threw his keys on.
Brought
the house down.
Yes, I remember that. Then, of course, that first season at the Island, it was, I don't say this with any ego, but it was 99% capacity for the season.
Yes.
And it was a joy going to work.
Do you know what, Jimmy? There were just as many locals as holidaymakers. The word got around, you've got to go and see Tarby at Sandown. And all the locals went along as well as the holidaymakers. They couldn't always get in.
Well, I'd rent homes in those days, so rent a house here and there when the kids had broken up from school. Oh, what a place for my kids. And twice on the Isle of Wight. We like it here, Dad. And they've been back with their own children, you know, and just all the Tarbucks, they say, it's a nice place here. It's nice, isn't it? And it is.
I was in Ventnor one morning fairly early and I saw you in a bread queuing for bread or rolls. And knowing you well, I refrained from shouting out, hello, Jimmy, because I thought you had sunglasses on.
Oh, yes.
Nobody knew who you were, so I just walked by.
They're very lucky, the Isle of Wight people. What do they call them again?
Corkheads.
Corkheads, because they eat the best of foods, especially out the water. You can't get fresher fish than there. It's glorious.
I know one night you said to me, I want to take you and your wife out for dinner after a show, right? So I rang up a place called the Taverners in Godshill, and I said, and they said, oh, sorry, sir, we close at about 10. I said, that's a pity. It was Jimmy Tarbutt. And they said, right, sir, we'll open.
Oh, dear.
There you go.
Did we go?
Yes.
Oh, great.
John Hannam, can't cook, won't cook, but what a sexy voice.
Winner takes all.
Yeah, a lot of fun that was.
Yes.
A lot of fun.
You did a few in a day, didn't you?
Oh, dear God. Well, it went on first just up north. Laurie Higgins found it, who was a sports director. I did it, and they just put it on up north. Then they put it on across the board. And it got to number one on several occasions when people had gambled the money and were continuing. And we had the all-time record at that time, which was £23,000. And this guy won it. He was out of work. And he said to me, may I buy the suit I wore, Mr. Tarbuck? I said, no, you can't. He went, oh, I am disappointed. I said, you can have the suit. He said, have it. I said, yes. I said, for what you've done for this show, people tuning in, let's see how that guy's getting on. I said, you took us to number one. And the director said, you're not in a position to give him the suit. I said, well, as a matter of fact, I am. The suit's yours, pal. Yes. And he left with not only his 23 grand, with a real nice whistle and flute. Oh, it was very enjoyable. Very enjoyable to do.
And of course, Wally Mostyn was involved with that show, wasn't he?
Yeah, Wal was there. Wal was in lots of things that I did, because he was very good at picking a line out. And I could always tell the Wally lines amongst all the script writers. That's one of yours. And he'd giggle. I'd just go, well done. And that.
Obviously, he grew up on the Isle of Wight and started writing for scout troops. But when he was still a dental mechanic, yes, right, he was writing for Bob Monkhouse. And when I think Bob was doing some palladiums, and Wally would sit there on a Sunday night, and Bob paid him a fiver a gag. And he'd say, well, that's mine, that's mine. I got 30 quid tonight. And then eventually he went full time, didn't he?
Well, he and then Wally paid me a fiver a gag for telling him.
Tarby's Frame Game, that was another one.
Yeah, another one we did. I mean, over the years now with YouTube and that, I look at things, oh, I don't remember this. And you know, you see things. And of course, who you've worked with, which has been wonderful. People that I absolutely idolized. And I'm very lucky who I've seen live. From rock and roll, I said Little Richard, but I've seen Jerry Lee. I've seen the Ebbs. I've seen Elvis Presley. It was wonderful to see them all, as well as our heroes, the Stones and everybody else, Joe Cocker. But the comics I've seen, and in many cases worked with, comics that mightn't be known over here. Rich Little, wonderful impressionist. Don Rickles, best insult comic I've ever seen. Alan King, wonderful. Bob Hope, hosting a thing with him and thinking, I'm enjoying this.
Did you begin life sweeping up in a lady's hairdresser?
Yes, I did.
Did you?
That was one of my jobs. I worked at a lady's hairdressing salon. Don't laugh.
No,
well, let me tell you, it was a great way of meeting girls. But yes. I used to lie to them in dance halls and say, yes, I'm a hairdresser at Andre Bernard's. Except they'd ring up, I'd like my hair done by Mr. Jimmy. They said, well, we haven't got a Mr. Jimmy. You don't mean Jimmy the apprentice who sweeps the floors. Yeah, I was found out.
You've come a long way since then, haven't you?
Yes. But lots of things have happened to me that I look back on and I thought, I wish that hadn't happened. I got stopped, Lynchy was driving, over the top, drunk, and he had a Mini. And this copper stopped the car. And he said, where do you live? And I'm in the front with Lynch, and Lynch said, no fixed abode. He went, and I started laughing. He said, where do you live? I said, above him. Well, the two of us laughing. We were in the next minute. We were in a police station. Yes, we got off, actually.
I'm sure you did.
Well, the sergeant was fans. The young copper wasn't.
You still love working, don't you?
Yeah, I love it. I still love getting up there. And it is a form. And believe me, Madonna, anybody, Bassey, Jones, Tarba, Des O'Connor. It's a lovely way to show off.
You got an OBE in 94, which was...
Yes, came right out the blue. I had no idea that was going to happen, and I was, and always have been, eternally grateful, because it made my family so proud. The outer circle of the relations, you know, nieces and nephews and uncles and aunts, so very proud. And then I received, I'm an officer of St. John of Jerusalem, which is given by the Queen, and I was very, very thrilled. And Pauline and I went to a very posh dinner at Windsor Castle. It was a huge, big charity night that was on, and it honours would be worn. So you wear your medals. And this bumptious lady said, "And what is that you've got on then? What are you wearing that for?" I said, "Which one?" "That one there, with the red and the cross." I said, "I won the monthly medal at Coombe Hill Golf Club." She said, "Well, you can't wear that tonight." I said, "Well, I'm honoured." And the husband just went to her, "Come away," and dragged her away. Paulie said, "Why didn't you say it was the OBE?" I said, "Well, I just thought I'd let her go her own way." And I imagine she'll be in, I don't know, Tesco's, and when saying he had the bloody monthly medal on from Coombe Hill Golf Club.
Looking back, just before you go, looking back on a fantastic career, any real regrets or not really?
Well, yes. I mean, I can't have any, want anything else. I'd be very greedy. I might have worked a bit harder at it, to be honest, but I was too busy having a good time and playing golf and playing football in guys' charity matches and exhibition games and playing football at Wembley. These are things, because I always wanted to do that. But the greatest thrill I've had out of it, bar none, John, was walking on the Palladium and hosting it on six series was just an incredible thrill for me, because nobody else has done that, not six series. And doing nine royal shows and walking on and doing the 100th one and walking on the stage with Des O'Connor, Ronnie Corbett, Bruce and I all together. And that will never be repeated again. And they should have used the four of us more that night together. But just being walking on with these three other friends who are icons in our business was a great, great thrill.
Yesterday, Bill Wyman. Today, Jimmy Tarbuck. So,
Bill Wyman's older than me.
He is.
Yes.
Yes. And me.
And he's older than you. Are you sure?
Thanks, Jimmy. Good luck.
Pleasure's mine.
It's great. He's got a swell personality. He meets and greets the stars with such amenity. Good enough to make you coming out of the street. John Hannah-May.
That's right. Grateful thanks, as ever, to the wonderful Jimmy Tarbuck. Jimmy and Des O'Connor have been touring in recent weeks, and they have some dates still to come. November the 3rd, the Orchard Theatre, Dartford. November the 9th, the De Montfort Hall, Leicester. And the Southampton Mayflower on November the 17th. Talking of Des O'Connor, I interviewed Des a few years ago, and talking of music heroes, one of his music heroes was the legendary Buddy Holly, and Des is now going to relate the story of how they met and toured together. Everyone remembers Des O'Connor was on a Buddy Holly tour. Fantastic, really, isn't it?
It was just the most extraordinary thing, because I wasn't going to do any more. And I told my agent at the time, I said, "These kids are throwing real rocks. I'm not going on any more rock shows." So I said, "You got any bread and butter shows?" You knew what I meant. I meant just ordinary shows, not rock and roll concerts. Because the kids didn't want to see the comic. And I almost turned that tour down when he said, "This guy Buddy Holly." I said, "I'd never heard of him." And I hadn't. A lot of us hadn't heard of him. But I took it, and we did 31 shows.
In 33 days?
33 days. So only 2 days. And I think even then we stayed. We didn't come back into London. We were up north somewhere. We had a day off. And he talked like that. He used to say, "How are you doing, Des?" "I'm all right, birdie." And this kind of giggly little friendship thing built up. I feel very privileged, because sadly that was the only the only tour he ever did. And he really was, we'd only, the tip of the iceberg, the songs that he could write on a bus. Some of the songs that I know now were written on a bus when I'd he may have had a tune in his head and a few words. And Norman Petty, his manager, would, they had a, like a miniature little kind of clavio, whatever it could, the first of the little portable organs, and he would play on that, and the crickets would make makeshift instruments, Jerry on a cornflake box and Joe on a skiffle bass. And I sometimes, when I wind that tape back in my head, I can see it and relive it all again and realise that I was there with Buddy Holly. And I'm so pleased that happened.
Telling me. Yeah. Did he actually give you a guitar?
I've got the guitar. Well, what happened was, obviously on a bus you can't plug in an electric guitar. And he had that very special. And of course they had these amplifiers, which we'd never seen before. It made more noise than the whole of the brass section of the band that was travelling with us. They were just two guys, and it was unbelievable, the noise. But he couldn't use an electric guitar on the bus, so he needed an acoustic guitar. So I took him into Maurice Plaquet Music Shop in Denmark Street in London. And I remember him going, yeah, that's all right, but let me hear another one. I thought, oh, God, he ran out of guitars in this shop. And I actually counted them, because they were putting them over to the side once he tried them. And it was the 17th guitar that he tried, a Hofner acoustic. And he said, I love this, got a real nice sound, going to have this one. And he took it, and he would play that on the coach. And at the end of the tour, he'd been teaching me a few chords, C, F, and G. And I'd been teaching him jokes, which he used to go and crack every night. He'd get bigger laughs than I ever would, because he did them in that fun kind of boys. Him doing jokes about football and supermarkets was wonderful. So I was privileged. It was a wonderful, wonderful period. It gave me a lot of confidence looking back, because I broke my barrier with the kids. You know? And there's a wonderful story that happened at Hammersmith, sitting on the last night, sitting in his dressing room, which was two floors up. A bit like, it doesn't matter, it's a dressing room. And suddenly, through the window, came a brick. Good Lord, all these kids are outside, hundreds of them screaming out there. And I went over to it. Luckily, none of the glass hit he or myself. And picked up an autograph book on a brick strap. It was elastic band. It was an autograph book. And on it said, we love you, buddy. Cheryl and Sharon or somebody. Could have killed him.
You've been listening to John Hannah Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.